Right. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Gloucester Writers Center. We're very excited to have Kevin Gallagher here in collaboration with the Cape Ann Forum. We are winding down our season at the Writers Center. We have a few more events coming up. This week we have on Friday our Fish Tales at the Gloucester Stage Company, which is a benefit for the Writers Center. The theme is Analyze This, and we have some great stories coming up about therapy. I know offhand that Brian King, Nathan Cohen, both have stories in. Do you know of anybody else? Kate Seidman is telling a story, and Israel Horovitz is sending a story to be read by somebody else or performed by somebody else. So it should be a great evening. There are tickets for that available either on the Gloucester Stage Company website, or there's also a link from the event on our website that can help you get tickets to that. Then on Monday at 7:30, we have our monthly open mic. Everybody can bring 5 minutes worth of words to share with the crowd. We look forward to seeing some faces there. Then on Wednesday, December 7th, Sarah Larson will be reading from her book, Mary Hell, which is a novel take on Helen of Troy, smashing together all different times and places, and maybe looking at it from a woman's point of view instead of the man's. Just a novel idea to discuss Helen of Troy as if she was a woman. So we have that. And then on December 11th, we are co-sponsoring Fire at Sea with the Cape Ann Forum and the Gloucester Lyceum, and that's going to be at the Cape Ann Community Cinema and Stage. And there are some more information about that on our website. Kevin Gallagher is an old friend, the editor of Spoke. He's a political economist, and this is where I'm going to forget what I'm supposed to say, so I'm going to look down. And he's he's the editor of Spoke, a Boston-based annual of poetry and poetics, and works as a professor of global development policy at Boston University's Pardee School for Global Studies. He's a great guy, a lot of fun, and it's incredible to see what he brings to poetry, having such a broad understanding of the world. And I'll let you talk about Loom, because you're the guy.
want me to go into here, yeah?
Because you're sure. That's
for
recording, yep.
Cool. Well, thanks, Amanda. Thanks, Henry, for having me and the Cape Ann Forum. This is my second Cape Ann Forum gig. I think I gave a Cape Ann Forum talk maybe 7 years ago when I lived here about how bad trade policy was for the Bush administration, but I'm going to stay so far away from that this time and hopefully and probably for the next 4 years and talk about poetry. And I was lucky to give a sort of sneak peek to my new book called Loom here in August when I just had the proofs. And I had 2 days to make my final edits on it. And I came here, Willie was here, a couple other folks were here, and I gave my last sort of unofficial take public, well, the first time I had actually read it to anybody besides my kids and my wife. And then I went after hearing it out loud to all you folks, and I made some edits, and here it is. I've got some copies here. It's called Loom. This is not a baseball bat. This is Billy Club from the Massachusetts Historical Society, from something called the League of Massachusetts Freemen. And they used to use these Billy Clubs to hunt down slaveholders. After the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which allowed Kansas and Nebraska to be new territories where we were letting the folks who lived there vote to decide whether or not they were going to be slave states or free states. In exchange for that, we had to bolster the Fugitive Slave Act, which said, well, if a slave escapes from the South and comes up to you crazy liberal northerners, and we catch him, if one of our slaveholder catches him, we try him and we bring him back to slavery and we treat him worse than we did before he escaped to treat his friends, to let his friends know that that's never going to happen. And so there was a number of secret societies in Boston, one of them being the League of Massachusetts Freemen, that used to carry around billy clubs, and if they would find out if you were a slaveholder, they would beat the hell out of you and send you back so that you also would not be, sorry about that, would not be, I got it. I think I got it. Ah, here we go. And I'll get to that in a minute. The book is called Loom. It is inspired by and adapted from the letters, journals, and stories of folks during antebellum Boston and antebellum slaveholding South. I think this has new meaning after our election, but it's actually the epic story of a period in our time when one of the richest men in America acted against his material interest for social justice and racial equality. Maybe it can happen again. The first poem is called Pirating the Power Loom, Francis Cabot Lowell to Nathan Appleton, 1813. I stole their designs with my own two eyes. I smuggled them to Boston in my mind. Exporting designs meant jail in Britain. Workers of looms weren't allowed to leave. So I snuck into Manchester myself. I made it back 2 days before the war. I saw iron cards and spinning jennies. I watched Luddites spin and weave all alone while the looms marched in teams and didn't rest. I said to myself, this has to come home. My baggage was searched twice at Halifax. They didn't find drawings of their machines. I sketched it all out in my memory. I had their designs in my mind with me. The power loom, which is the epicenter of the Industrial Revolution in the United States, was stolen by Francis Cabot Lowell with his photographic memory from Manchester, England, days before the War of 1812. And he brought it back here and had this engineer named Paul Moody. If you've been to Waltham and all the cool restaurants on Moody Street, well, they're all from Paul Moody. Paul Moody created the power loom in the United States, and the first factory is right there on the Charles on the corner of Moody Street. It was a perfect setup. They stole the designs. We went to war with Europe, and all of a sudden, with the United Kingdom, and all of a sudden, all the clothing and cotton that we were getting from the UK, cotton from their colonies in India, couldn't get in. And here in Massachusetts, we had the manufacturing, and we found a new place to get cotton, and that was the South, which was petering out. Not, I wouldn't say petering out on slavery, but had been slavery had sort of peaked because it was basically the core of it was focused on tobacco, and it was somewhat stagnant. But the new demand for cotton from the Massachusetts cotton mills, which the one on Moody Street wasn't big enough, and they found out that these big, huge waterways in the Merrimack had much stronger waterways for the hydropower that fueled the factories. That they moved up there, and Lowell and Lawrence named the two towns after them and built these big things here in the abolitionist free North. But we actually triggered slavery in the South in so doing. This poem's called The Lowest Class. There were just two classes to the white folks, buckra slave owners and poor white folks that didn't own no slaves. There was more classes amongst the slaves. The first class was the house servants. Then was the butler, the maids, the nurses, chambermaids, and cooks. The next day was the carriage drivers, the gardeners, the carpenter, the barber, and the stablemen. Then come the next class, the wheelwright, wagoners, blacksmith, slave foreman. The next class I members was the cowmen and the niggers that care for the dogs. All these have good houses and never get a beating. Then come the cradlers of the wheat, the threshers. Then come the feeders of the cotton gin. But the lowest class are the cotton field niggers. There was so much demand for cotton up here that they maximized all the land that they were using at the time. And so Andrew Jackson passed something called the Indian Removal Act, which basically said, all of you folks who are Native Americans in these handful of states in the Southeast, you have to get out of here and move to Oklahoma. This poem's called Removal Act, 1830. Maize, beans, squash, the three sisters. Rabbit, deer, fish, pots, baskets, clothes. Trade you skins and fur, otter, lynx, fox, for knives, axes, muskets, gunpowder, and scarlet ribbon. We need your unused lands. You better master the arts of civilization or go west to the Mississippi, Alabama, half of Georgia, western Tennessee, the Creeks, Cherokee, Chickasaws, a trail. Horses and oxen standing up in the mud, stiff and bones. One wagon for every 50, for children, for elders, for the rest of us, on foot, in tears. Bayonets at our backs and disease ahead. One of the things that Francis Cabot Lowell wrongly observed when he went to Manchester to pirate the power loom was he saw that all the Luddites were having these big strikes, and he thought he had an ingenious idea coming back to Massachusetts, was that there was all this surplus female labor and in the countryside here in Massachusetts, all these women who were helpful in the beginning part of the seed planting period and certainly helpful in the harvest, but there wasn't a heck of a lot for them to do around the house. And he said, around the farms, and he said, oh, I've got a great idea. I can get these folks to work in these factories. They'll be docile. They'll never strike. And they'll get money, so they can go out in the big cities of Lowell and Lawrence and have a good time at night, so they'll be happy with that. But they'll also send some of their money home, which will help their fathers and their farms, and we'll also make sure that that we're not producing anything, and so they can go home during harvest period and harvest. It was a complex situation for a lot of these women, because they did have this freedom that they hadn't had in the farms with their fathers and having to work in the farmland. And a lot of them thrived. They created one of the first literary magazines in the United States in Massachusetts was something called the Lowell Offering, which was by women workers in the factories up there. And a poet who was prominent during that is a woman named Lucy Larcom. And she was really torn about all this and also understood the connection to the South. This poem's called Lucy Larcom. I ask you, how much of your wrong is mine as I change bobbins in the spinning room? As the waters glide and our shuttles fly, you toil in ghastly death-sown fields that lie. All day I stand before a power loom. I ask you, how much of your wrong is mine, down underneath the tearless southern sky? My family needs me to send money home. As the waters glide and our shuttles fly, it isn't very hard to draw straight lines. I work here 5 years, then find a groom. I ask you, how much of your wrong is mine? I cannot weave when I'm wearing blinds. I'm not alone because I am with you. As the waters glide and the shuttles fly, clasp my hands and look right in my eyes. You will see the sun of the southern sky. As my shuttle flies and the water glides, I ask you, how much of your wrong is mine? Another woman who was a poet and published in the Lowell Offering is a woman named Harriet Hanson Robinson, who became really well known as a woman suffragist, but she got politicized in the mills of Lowell, and she largely instigated the first strike in Lowell. So Francis Cabot Lowell was wrong, and I guess you folks, this crowd, I think I said this the last time, this crowd's the only one who's going to basically get what the second section of my book is called. It's called Polis Was This. I've said that in other places, and I don't know what I'm talking about. This poem's called Turnout, Harriet Hanson Robinson, 1835. When the cotton is all spun and all our work is done, the boss man takes the money and we get close to none. Now they want to cut our wages, make us pay our own board. We have to show our faces in the name of the Lord. I know what I have to do. I'm going to turn out. I ask that you will join me too, march with me and shout. Oh, isn't it a pity that such a pretty girl as I should be sent to the factory to pine away and die? Oh, I cannot be a slave, for I am so fond of liberty that I cannot be a slave. No, I cannot be a slave. This song that she sort of wrote and I did a variation of was actually mentioned by John Floyd, the governor of Virginia, when he wrote a letter to the mayor of Boston in 1831 blaming the Nat Turner Rebellion when slaves rebelled against their slaveholders in Virginia on Boston abolitionists. And he even mentioned he mentioned the Boston abolitionists, and he also said, "And your Lowell girls sing, or so we are told, I'm so fond of liberty, I cannot be a slave. Prepare for some harsh resolutions towards your manufacturers, friends. You people up north must go hanging those fanatical wretches if you would not lose your southern trade." So this is the beginning of a tension between the North and South, what Senator Charles Sumner called the unholy alliance between the Lords of the Loom and the Lords of the Lash. I'm not going to read that full poem, but the Lowell Lawrence families and the Boston Brahmin elite took that to heart, and they did not want to lose their livelihood, and they started hiring thugs to shut down abolitionist demonstrations and lectures that they had. I have a poem that I'm not going to read about the mayor of Boston meeting with the female anti-slavery society. There were lots of free women, African-American women, and abolitionist white women who had their own societies here, and they would have their own meetings. And these folks were going to have William Lloyd Garrison give a talk there. And the mayor went there and said, "You better not do this because something bad is going to happen." They did it anyway. And I'll read that poem. It's called The Liberator, William Lloyd Garrison, 1835. Thousands of genteel ruffians crawled out, "Lynch him! Lynch him! Hang him in the common! Turn him a right nigger color with tar!" I ran and jumped out the back window only to land on an even larger mob. The Cooley brothers pinned both my shoulders, then lashed a rope three times around my chest. I was dragged through Wilson's Lane to State Street, to the spot of the Boston Massacre. They tore off my clothes and they kicked my face. The light of day did not cause them to care, so the mayor jailed me to keep me safe. Another day devoted to thy cause, not till war is over will I pause. I just showed you that etching. These poems are adapted from the letters and diaries of these folks, as I said, and at the Boston Athenaeum, at the Boston Public Library, at the Library of Congress. I wrote some of this while I was living in Washington a couple years ago. At the Massachusetts Historical Society, my publisher is such an awesome guy. He said, I had a bunch of images sort of tacked on my wall when I was writing this stuff, and I stuffed them in the envelope when I submitted the book to just sort of give him the mood of the whole thing. He said, "Oh, you should put these in there." And so the book, I got permission, and he paid for the ones where the people insisted that they had to be paid for it. And it has about 19 etchings in here, and engravings from the time, which I'm really grateful for them putting in there. So everything changes during the Anthony Burns trial. Anthony Burns was a fugitive slave who escaped from Alexandria and came to Boston. And I'll go with the story a little bit later. Anthony Burns, Boston, May 24th, 1854. I didn't want to make myself known. I didn't tell who I was. I got employed. I came to work. I worked hard. I kept my own counsel. I strove for myself. I didn't say I was a slave. I was going home one night. I heard someone behind me. I felt a hand on my shoulder. I heard the cannons, I think from the common. I hear because the Nebraska bill just passed. "Stop, stop. You're the fellow that just broke into the silversmith shop." I said he was mistaken. I was lifted off my feet, I think by six or seven others. I could not resist. I could not speak. I waited in the courthouse. I waited for some time. I said I wanted to go home. I said I wanted my supper. I waited in the jail. How do you do, Mr. Burns? Said the man who opened the door. I said, I am fine, my master. Did I ever whip you, Anthony? I said, no. Did I not, when you were sick, take my bed from my own house for you? I said, yes. Did you ever ask me for money when it was not given to you? I said, I do recollect that you gave me 12.5 cents at the end of every year. I was taken down with bracelets on my wrists. No, not such as you wear, ladies, of gold and silver. I was taken down with bracelets on my wrists, iron and steel manacles that wore into my bone. So Anthony Burns is captured and tried in the city of Boston at the courthouse. And abolitionists all over the area appoint a self-appointed defense, and they try to defend him. Some people try to cut deals with the slaveholders to just buy his freedom and take him to Canada. But the Virginians were just so pissed off about it that they wouldn't take any price. I mean, these people are Bostonians. They're loading up with money, offering all this money for this guy. They wouldn't do it. And so they attacked the courthouse on May 27th, 1854. And I have an old engraving from it. You can't see it here, but there's actually an engraving of that was in the papers at the time of the attack on the courthouse, where we have Boston abolitionists attacking the courthouse by federal marshals, also Bostonians, or Irish immigrants and stuff like that, protecting the Southern cavalry surrounding an escaped slave in a Boston courthouse. Totally insane. Rescue attempt. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, May 27th, 1854. There is now no law in Massachusetts. When law ceases, we act in sovereignty. We rush State Street like a sweep of wave. We started breaking out the battle axes and battering ram for the front door. We threw brickbats to break the windows. The guards started shooting us from above. Surrounding crowds screamed, "Take him out! Rescue him!" Muzzles flashed and pistols cracked behind us. We pounded inside and started stabbing. We killed an Irishman from the marshal's guard. They clubbed us back on the streets with the crowds. Their cutlasses proved too much for us. Cowards, would you desert us now? So they lost the case, or Anthony Burns lost the case, and the Virginians made one big mistake. Again, they were so aggravated about this stuff that they had brought up a whole cavalry. And they, once he was given back to the slaveholders, they paraded him through the streets of Boston. There's one etching that survives of it. You can't really see it here in Court Square, where they've got Anthony Burns in the middle and all these cavalry and all these horses and all these troops parade him through the streets of Boston. And there's a massive protest around them, where the federal marshals are keeping all the protesters away from. They got northern marshals keeping abolitionist protesters away from the southern cavalry, which is taking this slave back to slavery, and they're carrying black coffins in the air while they're doing it, and that's the moment when Amos A. Lawrence, who was referred to as the Prince of the Cotton Whigs, the Whig Party was the solidified party at the time, and the coalition between the Northern and Southern Whigs were referred to the Cotton Whigs, because they wore wigs, like used to wear wigs in Congress at the time, but it was symbolic of the cotton that connected the two of them between the North and the South. And so obviously Lawrence, Lowell, Appleton, all these families were the core financiers of the party, and Amos A. Lawrence, the son of the original Lawrence brothers, was at the middle of that. But this is a depiction of him watching this and just saying, wow, this has gone too far. And he said that day that's the day he became a stark mad abolitionist. I put my hands in my face and I wept. I went to bed an old-fashioned conservative. I woke up a stark mad abolitionist. Look what you've done. I can do nothing else. You've given me a new purpose to live. I put my hands in my face and I wept. Then I put myself into his footsteps, Burns is a hero, not a fugitive. I'm a stark mad abolitionist. I will see to it that we free Kansas. Your betrayal is my strongest motive. I put my hands in my face and I wept, but woke up a new man after I slept. I will give everything I can give, because I am a stark mad abolitionist. Anthony Burns, I will never forget. Stephen Douglas, I will never forgive. I put my hands in my face and I wept. Now I'm a stark mad abolitionist. Richard Henry Dana, the next day, May 26, 1854, writes this in his diary because Amos A. Lawrence came to him and he just can't believe what he said. This poem's called Skunk Peculiarities. I found Amos A. Lawrence at my door, a man who has long appeased slave power. He said he wanted to go on record, that he changed his mind in the final hour. The man who helped to arrest Shadrach, the man who paid to send back Thomas Sims, the man whose textile girls say they are slaves, the man whose mob may have dragged Garrison, told me he will spend whatever it takes to help defend this fugitive slave. Nebraska and Burns were too much for him to take. We're no runaway hunting ground, he told me. Now we have the solid men of Boston on our side and on the side of freedom. And he does become a stark mad abolitionist. He does two things. One, he starts financing these folks with the billy clubs to find slaveholders in Boston and send them back. And I found out about this secret society called the Boston Anti-Manhunting League, run by this guy named Henry Bowditch. And in the Massachusetts Historical Society, they have their secret notebooks. And Lawrence, all these guys were members of them, but they had secret names, and they logged them in there. And they kept minutes, you know, so gentlemanly, they kept minutes of all their meetings. And I found in the file this big, huge poster that I kept opening up and opening up, and I put it on this big table. And it was their plan to how to surround and beat up a slaveholder. And I'll try to read this poem while showing this to you folks. It might be tough. Boston Anti-Manhunting League, Henry I. Bowditch, 1854. A committee of six, prudent, young, true, and stalwart comrades, with one elder speaker, are first to try our hands at reason. But if the southern blood arises, the speaker signals, and we begin the snaking out. Keep the slave hunter in the center. The committee speaker, S, stays in back. C member takes hold of the hunter's head, and A1 and A2 take hold of the arms. F1 and F2 take hold of the feet, pretending to try and rescue SH, the slaveholder. 12 more with oak billies loaded with lead surround the group and rush to our carriage. One plagued in this way will not invite others. The other thing that he did was finance people from Boston, people from Massachusetts who weren't doing so well, and he said, I'll finance you to move to Kansas and start your own new life there, as long as you vote when they vote whether or not things are going to be free or pro-slavery, if you vote for it to be a free state. And Lawrence, Kansas, is named after Lawrence from Lawrence, Massachusetts. And it was if you looked at the maps during the election, there's this tiny little blue speck right in there, and it's Lawrence, Kansas, for people from Massachusetts. From those days, it's basically all that's out there. This is being recorded. I'm going to get shot. here's a letter that Amos A. Lawrence wrote to President Pierce, because when he sent out all these folks from Massachusetts to Kansas to vote free state, the governor of Missouri was sending people in at night from Missouri to vote the other way. And this poem's called Letter to President Pierce, Amos A. Lawrence, July 15th, 1855. It's evident that there is a body of men in Missouri most determined to drive our people from Kansas. I must say that if they dare to do so, they will permanently suffer consequences. You have a problem with the settlers from the free states opposed to the introduction of the slave trade. I note that you have now forced those settlers to the conclusion that if they be safe, they must defend themselves out there. I, too, have come to the same conclusion. I have therefore rendered them assistance by furnishing them such means of defense. And the such means of defense that he furnished these folks is that he hired John Brown to go out there and defend him. And the battles of Osawatomie, the famous battles of Bleeding Kansas, were all financed by Amos A. Lawrence. Sharp's rifles that were purchased here and sent out there. Here is a poem called Farmers Turn Soldiers, Amos A. Lawrence to Dr. Charles Robinson, 1855. When farmers turn soldiers, they must have arms. To fight for freedom, you will need a gun. Never again shall they burn down your barns. To protect your freedom, I send you John Brown. He has the look of a determined one. When farmers turn soldiers, they must have arms. This is a simple case of right and wrong. I send Sharp's rifles so the ruffians run. Never again shall they burn down your barns. You must defend yourself. Sound the alarms. If they want to fight, they will be outdone. When farmers turn soldiers, they must have arms. You can't afford your livelihood scarred. Think of your wives, your daughters, your sons. Never again shall they burn down your barns. We have to appeal to the higher laws. Everyone is equal under the sun. When farmers turn soldiers, they must be armed. Never again shall they burn down your barns. The last poem I'll read is called The Last Full Measure of Devotion. My sword got stuck between his ribs. I kicked my foot into his chest. I pulled it out with both hands. In the same motion, I swung right into the gut of another. He hit the ground. I grabbed his Colt. I shot one who was charging me with a rifle and bayonet soaked with blood and blue cloth. Without support of any kind, Captain said, retire by prolong so McGlivery could fill the gap. We went quiet when he said, hold position at all hazards. I thrust my sword even harder into a Mississippi thigh as he tried to kick it from my hand and go after our best gunner. I used rammer heads. I used hand spikes. I kicked him in the groin. I kneed him in the face. Then I shot him in the stomach. There was so much smoke around me, I didn't know their numbers. Too many Barksdale sharpshooters. Too many from South Carolina. Too many 21st Mississippi. Too many rocks from our wooden wheels. Too many dying men and horses to move our Napoleons back. We saw Bigelow get shot twice, but the bugler took him to the rear. We kept on trying to fight. I got stabbed twice in the ankle. I felt the shell go in my side. My eyes were wide open when I died. Thank you.